Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 233. Hey, but who's counting? It's Monday, October 23rd. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, let's get started with something that cannot be ignored. The conflict in Israel and Gaza, of course, the worst of it, is falling on Gaza. This from the Associated Press. A view from the nightmare of Gaza's hospitals. The only thing worse than the screams of a patient undergoing surgery without enough anesthesia are the terror-stricken faces of those awaiting their turn, a 50-year-old orthopedic surgeon says. When the Israeli bombing intensifies and the wounded swamp the Gaza City hospitals, where Dr. Nidal Abed works, he treats patients wherever he can, on the floor, in the corridors, in rooms crammed with 10 patients instead of 2. Without enough medical supplies, Abed makes do with whatever he can find, clothes for bandages, vinegar for antiseptic, sewing needles for surgical ones. Hospitals in the Gaza Strip are nearing collapse under the Israeli blockade that cut power and deliveries of food and other necessities to the territory. They lack clean water. They are running out of basic items for easing pain and preventing infections. Fuel for the generators is dwindling. When Israel cut fuel to the territory's sole power plant 2 weeks ago, Gaza's rumbling generators kicked in to keep life support equipment running in hospitals. Authorities are desperately scrounging up diesel to keep them going. United Nations agencies are distributing their remaining stocks. Motorists are emptying their gas tanks. In some hospitals, the lights have already switched off. At Nasser Hospital in the southern city of Khan Yunis this week, nurses and surgical assistants held their iPhones over the operating table, guiding the surgeons with the flashlights as they snipped. At Shifa Hospital, Gaza's biggest, where Abed also worked this week, the intensive care unit runs on generators, but most other wards are without power. Air conditioning is a bygone luxury. Abed catches beads of sweat dripping from his patients' foreheads as he operates. People wounded in the airstrikes are overwhelming the facilities. Hospitals don't have enough beds for them. Even a normal hospital with equipment would not be able to deal with what we're facing, Abed said. It would collapse. Shifa Hospital, with a maximum capacity of 700 people, is treating 5,000 people, General Director Mohammed Abu Salmiya says. Lines of patients, some in critical condition, snake out of operating rooms. The wounded lie on floors or on gurneys, sometimes stained with the blood of previous patients. Doctors operate in crowded corridors filled with moans. The scenes, infants arriving alone to intensive care because no one else in their family survived, patients awake and grimacing in pain during surgeries, have traumatized Abed into numbness. But what still pains him is having to choose which patients to prioritize. You have to decide, he said, because you know that many will not make it. So this horror that is happening is just an exclamation point on the fact that war is a public health issue and a public health nightmare. It would take more than the entire time of this show to get to even to touch, to scratch the background, but can easily be said that war crimes targeting civilian populations, specifically hospitals and schools and even just residences, is a war crime. And of course, this is all under the background of Israeli occupation, Israeli apartheid, and settler colonialism that has tainted, poisoned, It's created a toxic and violent social environment for generations. This is a public health crisis, and we need to recognize that it's something that's been in the making for decades, as many public health crises are. We tend to get attention with crises, but as soon as we build bombs and weapons and armaments rather than meeting actual human needs, the death begins. Okay, well, next up, I want to do a little bit of a different kind of story, more general. The way that we make choices in our life impacts the world around us and how we interact with it. And of course, that affects public health. And in a world of polycrises, many crises happening at once, this is important for us as human beings. This from Medical Express. I'd rather not know why we choose ignorance. When given the choice to learn how their actions will affect someone else, 40% of people will choose ignorance, often in order to have an excuse to act selfishly, according to recent research. Examples of such willful ignorance abound in everyday life, such as when consumers ignore information about the problematic origins of the products they buy, said lead author Lynn Vu, a doctoral candidate at the University of Amsterdam. We wanted to know just how prevalent and how harmful willful ignorance is, as well as why people engage in it. Across the studies, the researchers found that when given an option, 40% of people choose not to learn the consequences of their actions. That willful ignorance was correlated with less altruism. People were 16% more likely to be generous to someone else when they were told the consequences of their choice compared to when they were allowed to remain ignorant. The researchers hypothesized that one reason for willful ignorance might be that some people behave altruistically because they want to maintain a positive self-image of being an altruistic person. In those cases, willful ignorance can allow them to maintain that self-image without actually having to act in an altruistic way. People who choose to learn the consequence of their actions were 7% more likely to be generous compared with participants who were given information by default. That suggests that truly altruistic people choose to learn the consequences of their actions. The findings are fascinating as they suggest a lot of the altruistic behaviors we observe are driven by a desire to behave as others are expected to do. While most people are willing to do the right thing when they are fully informed of the consequences of their actions, this willingness is not always because people care for others. A part of the reason why people act altruistically is due to societal pressures, as well as their desire to view themselves in a good light. Since being righteous is often costly, demanding people to give up their time, money, and effort, ignorance offers an easy way out. So, I often kind of joke, to keep from crying, about this show, that it's often very depressing. There's a lot of realities out there that are very harsh and difficult to look at. But from the time we were small children, the way that we learn the world works is we learn the consequences of actions, our own and others. That's how we learn how to navigate in the world accurately. And in the ultimate case, humanely and altruistically. May we continue to have the courage and the energy to look at the world in all of its defects and glory and learn to treat one another well. But of course, that is not always the case. And that's highlighted by this story from the 19th. How Roe v. Wade's overturn impacted domestic violence survivors. Domestic violence calls about reproductive coercion doubled after the overturn of Roe. Reports of abuse involving reproductive coercion, that is, actions that prevent someone from making crucial decisions about their body and reproductive health, nearly doubled in the year-long period after Roe v. Wade was overturned, according to new data from the National Domestic Violence Hotline. The reproductive coercion can take the form of any situation in which one partner is exerting power over another in a way that impacts their reproductive health. That could be forcing someone to engage in sexual activity, refusing to use contraception, restricting a partner from seeing a healthcare provider, telling a partner they are not allowed to receive abortion care. That increase is especially alarming, experts say, because being pregnant increases a person's risk of being hurt or killed by an intimate partner. Homicide is the leading cause of death of people who are pregnant or have given birth within a year in the United States, surpassing dangerous complications such as eclampsia and hemorrhage. We are really dealing with the criminalization of healthcare and the ability of someone to travel to get an abortion, to ask their friends for help, let alone actually get an abortion. These are now all points of leverage for an abuser. Intimate partner violence is a factor in 64% of all homicides of pregnant and postpartum people, and more than half of all homicides committed against pregnant and postpartum people occur in the person's own home. Black women, who are already disproportionately impacted by restrictions on abortion access, are also disproportionately impacted by the threat of intimate partner homicide among pregnant women. The Supreme Court is hearing a case next month that may further change the risk factors that pregnant people in abusive relationships face. United States v. Rahimi is about whether or not the federal law barring individuals who have standing domestic violence restraining order against them from possessing guns is constitutional. Experts point to the links between pregnancy, abuse, and death by gun violence, as well as the rise in calls to the hotline in the year after the Dobbs decision, as critical context about the stakes in the Rahimi case. For goodness sakes, can we keep armaments out of the hands of people with a standing domestic violence restraining order? Let's make it so, people. Okay, well, let's switch to some much better news. This from Kaiser Family Foundation Health News. Healthcare game changer. Feds boost care for homeless Americans. The Biden administration is making it easier for doctors and nurses to treat homeless people wherever they find them, from creekside encampments to freeway underpasses, marking a fundamental shift in how and where healthcare is delivered. As of October 1st, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services began allowing public and private insurers to pay for, quote, street medicine providers for medical services they deliver any place homeless people might be staying. Previously, these providers weren't getting paid by most Medicaid programs, which serve low-income people, because the services weren't delivered in traditional medical facilities, such as hospitals and clinics. The change comes in response to the swelling number of homeless people across the country and the skyrocketing number of people who need intensive addiction and mental health treatment, in addition to medical care for wounds, pregnancy, and chronic diseases like diabetes. It's a game changer. Before, this was really all done on a volunteer basis, said Valerie Arkosh, Secretary of Pennsylvania's Department of Human Services, which spearheaded a similar state-based billing change in July. We are so excited. Instead of a doctor's office, routine medical treatments and preventive care can now be done wherever unhoused people are. It's a bombshell, said David Letrick, executive director of the Pittsburgh-based nonprofit Bridge to the Mountains, which provides outreach services to street medicine teams in Pennsylvania. Before, you could provide extensive primary care and even some specialty care under a bridge, but you couldn't bill for it. Under the new rule, doctors, nurses, and other providers can get reimbursed to care for patients in a, quote, non-permanent location on the street or found environment, making it the first time the federal government has recognized the streets as a legitimate place to provide health care. This will primarily affect low-income, disabled, and older people on Medicaid and Medicare. Nearly 600,000 people are homeless in America, based on federal estimates from 2022. And on average, they die younger than those who have stable housing. The life expectancy for homeless people is 48, compared with the overall life expectancy of 76 years in the United States. More than 150 street medicine programs operate across the country, according to street medicine experts. At least 50 are in California, which is up from 25 in 2022, said Brett Feldman, director of street medicine at the University of Southern California School of Medicine. Street medicine experts argue that by dramatically expanding primary and specialty care on the streets, they can interrupt the cycle of homelessness and reduce costly ambulance rides, hospitalizations, and repeated trips to the emergency room. Street medicine could help save California 300,000 ER trips annually, Feldman projected, based on Medicaid data. Some street medicine teams are even placing people into permanent housing. But the federal change, undertaken quietly by the Biden administration, needs a major public messaging campaign to get other states on board and to entice more providers to participate, said Jim Withers, a longtime street medicine provider in Pittsburgh who founded the Street Medicine Institute. This is just the beginning, and it's a wake-up call because so many people are left out of healthcare, he said. Of course, the practice of any healthcare is benefited by being centered around the patient, and that includes going where the patients are rather than making them come to you. Okay, next, let's talk about the second leading cause of death in the world, stroke. This from the Washington Post. Strokes could kill nearly 10 million people a year by 2050, research predicts. Worldwide stroke deaths could increase by 50% by 2050, killing as many as 9.7 million people each year, an international group of stroke research predicted in a report in Lancet Neurology. Young people and those in low and middle-income countries face even higher increases, the report says. Stroke is the second leading cause of death worldwide and causes disability, dementia, and other health problems in millions each year. Although strokes are common, deaths are unequally distributed, with 86% occurring in low and middle-income nations, and a growing number affecting people under age 55. The researchers blame unequally distributed healthcare resources, a lack of prevention programs, pollution, lifestyle factors, and other issues for the high number of stroke deaths. The world ignores stroke's public health burden at its own peril, they suggest, projecting that costs of stroke treatments and lost income will rise from $891 billion per year in 2017 to up to $2.3 trillion by 2050. Despite the crisis, the researchers note that stroke is highly preventable and treatable. Lifestyle factors such as healthy diet, regular physical activity, and stopping smoking can reduce stroke risk, as can regular monitoring of conditions such as high blood pressure. Okay, well, next up, I want to do a companion piece to that and talk about one of the main domains for stroke prevention. This from nutritionfacts.org, eating for stroke prevention. Strokes are one of the leading causes of death and disability in the world. They are the most common cause of seizures in the elderly, the second most common cause of dementia, and a frequent cause of major depression. In short, stroke is burdensome but preventable. How to prevent a stroke? According to the Global Burden of Disease Study, the largest study of risk factors for human disease in history, more than 90% of the stroke burden is attributable to modifiable risk factors. For example, about 10% of all healthy years of life lost due to stroke may be due to ambient air pollution. Moving away from a city to a more rural area with cleaner air is an option to modify that risk factor, but it may be easier to quit smoking if you smoke, which accounts for 18% of stroke, death, and disability. Diets high in salt are as bad as smoking when it comes down to stroke burden, but not as harmful as inadequate fruit and vegetable consumption. Other factors, like sedentary lifestyle, are at play, but they aren't even as bad as not eating enough whole grains, for instance. As with heart disease, a plant-based diet can reduce stroke risk by reducing cholesterol and blood pressure, while improving blood flow and antioxidant capacity. Most of the studies on plant-based dietary patterns have found a protective effect against stroke, whereas those looking at westernized eating habits based more on animal foods, added sugars, and fats have found a detrimental effect. So I've talked about this before. I just want to go back and visit one part of that, which is looking that actually inadequate fruit and vegetable consumption is worse than actually diets high in salt. So salt is definitely a problem because it causes high blood pressure. That's one of the main drivers. But potassium is kind of the sister nutrient to sodium, which is what's in salt, and that's what you get from fruits and vegetables. And we not only have an excess of sodium from salt, but we have a deficiency of potassium from fruit and vegetable consumption. And particularly when those are in tandem, it's particularly dangerous. Also, this eating for stroke prevention is a good example of one of the things that we see, at least as far as westernized eating habits. You know, it talks about animal foods and added sugars and fats, but that's also part of what we see with the rising trend of ultra-processed foods, not only in the U.S., which is number one, with almost two-thirds of our food is ultra-processed, but ultra-processed foods are rising in consumption around the world. And that's why in the earlier story, when you see low and middle-income countries with rising stroke, and particularly younger and younger, we're seeing that in conjunction with the rise of ultra-processed foods, a sign that our food system is unhealthy, making us unhealthy.
And now for a word from our lack of sponsors. PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal health care. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
Of course, in public health, one of the basic principles we learn is that you can look at the average across a population for a particular like prevalence of a disease or particular risk factor, but those things are rarely distributed evenly. They're often concentrated in what is often appropriately called vulnerable populations. Well, this next story from Roll Call is an example of that. CDC sees inconsistent gains in HIV prevention prescriptions. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention published preliminary data showing that more than one-third of individuals eligible for a commonly used HIV prevention drug received a prescription, as funding for critical HIV program grew 16-fold between fiscal years 2019 through 2023. But the reach of this strategy is highly inconsistent among racial groups. Pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP, is a drug used to reduce transmission of HIV after exposure and is recommended for individuals at high risk of contracting HIV. While all racial and ethnic groups showed some gains in prescriptions, the changes among Black and Hispanic or Latino individuals were minor, according to the report. The percentage of eligible white individuals who were prescribed PrEP grew from 60% in 2019 to 94% in 2022. Among Hispanic or Latino individuals, that number only grew from 15% to 24%, and in Black individuals, it grew from 8% to 13%. So that's kind of stunning that you can get 94% among whites, but not even a quarter or about an eighth among Hispanic or Black and Latino folks. Wow. Okay, well, let's switch gears and look at a story that really highlights one of the changes that's happening in the world when we move to virtual reality. This from NPR, the story behind soaring myopia among kids. That's nearsightedness. The World Health Organization warns that by 2030, 40% of the world's population will be nearsighted. In the U.S. alone, myopia rates have soared over the past 50 years, from 25% in 1971 to nearly 42% in 2017. Many of these myopia cases are in children, who are going nearsighted at increasingly younger ages. In China, where they specifically track early onset myopia, over 80% of teens and young adults are now nearsighted. There's been a long-standing debate over why so many kids are going nearsighted, because bad eyesight used to be attributed solely to genetics. Now, experts agree that something else is going on, resulting from a shift in how children spend the majority of their time. And this is the gist of it. Too little time outside, too much time indoors, often staring at screens. For a young child whose eyes are still developing, these habits cause their eyes to prioritize near vision rather than distance vision. In turn, their eyeballs begin to elongate, triggering nearsightedness. We're talking about children who are age 4 or 5 years old becoming myopic, said Dr. Maria Liu, an associate professor of clinical optometry at the University of California, Berkeley. Early onset myopia can lead to dangerous vision problems later in life, including retinal detachment, glaucoma, cataracts, and even complete loss of vision. Dr. Liu explained that the best way to protect children against early onset myopia is to limit screen time and to get them playing outside as much as possible. They need to play with real toys, Liu said. They need to engage in real outdoor life. This advice goes for adults, too. Dr. Liu suggests taking regular outdoor breaks to scan the horizon for 3 to 5 minutes in order to exercise our distance vision. She notes that these breaks are most effective after a sustained amount of near work, and that sunlight itself is highly protective against myopia as well. And one further caveat, looking out the window or looking around a large indoor space doesn't count. Our eyes can sense the walls and ceilings when we are indoors, which crowds our peripheral vision, according to Liu. Thus, getting fully outdoors is the key. So, limit that screen time, and particularly if you have a lot of screen time, get outside, exercise that distance vision, especially for kids who are still developing their eyes. And in another story that's focused on little kids, this is from Medical Express, new report spills the milk on toddler so-called formulas, questions marketing of drinks. Toddler formulas that are promoted as nutritious drinks for the older infant or preschooler are generally unnecessary and nutritionally incomplete, and the marketing practices that promote them are questionable, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics. Products that are advertised as, quote, follow-up formulas or weaning formulas or toddler milks and formulas are misleadingly promoted as a necessary part of a healthy child's diet or for those directed at young infants, equivalent to infant formula. These drinks should not replace a balanced diet and are inferior to standard infant formula in children less than 12 months of age and offer no benefit over much less expensive cow's milk in most children older than age 12 months. Just another example of how we're trying to put kids on an ultra-processed diet. These diets are completely ultra-processed. There is actually no real food in them. They're just sugar and protein drinks with like vitamin pills in them. Not good. So the advice, eat real food. And if your kid is young, that includes breast milk, which is the best for young children.
And now a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away, from endemic racism that nobody seems to see, try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted. Or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, next up, let's talk about Medicaid, the federal government health insurance program for low-income folks. And there was a Medicaid expansion that was huge with the original Affordable Care Act, or quote, Obamacare, but the Supreme Court ruled that states did not have to expand if they didn't want to, and there is still 10 holdouts, even a decade later. This from Stateline.org. 10 Medicaid holdout states scrambled to improve health coverage. The Republican-led states that have refused to expand Medicaid are trying a variety of strategies to save struggling hospitals and cover more people without full expansion, which was one of the key provisions of the Affordable Care Act. But healthcare advocates say these efforts are weak substitutes for full expansion, especially as non-expansion states continue to fare poorly on most health metrics. A decade after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that states' participation in Medicaid expansion was voluntary, the 10 holdouts, plus North Carolina, which recently approved expansion but hasn't implemented it yet, account for most of the rural hospital closures over the past decade, according to the American Hospital Association. They tend to have the highest percentages of uninsured adults, the highest infant and maternal mortality rates, and their residents are more likely to suffer from chronic diseases such as heart disease and diabetes. More Republican lawmakers in the past few years have softened to the idea that there's something inherently not working in their state's healthcare system, that people aren't getting access to care, doctors aren't being incentivized to stay, hospitals aren't open, said Jane Adams, government relations director for the American Cancer Society's Cancer Action Network in Alabama. But they haven't yet come to the conclusion that you must close the coverage gap first before you can address these other problems. Sponsors of Medicaid expansion have long argued that giving more people health insurance would improve health outcomes and help keep the doors open at financially strapped hospitals, especially in rural areas. But GOP critics in the non-expansion states, which are Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Kansas, Mississippi, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, Wisconsin, and Wyoming say it's too expensive, question its effectiveness, or remain ideologically opposed to government-funded health care. Every state operates its own Medicaid program within broad federal guidelines, using both state and federal money. The federal government picks up between 50 and 78% of the cost, depending on each state's per capita income. Under the 2010 Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, states were empowered to expand Medicaid coverage results with incomes up to 138% of their federal poverty level, which is about $120,000 for an individual, with the federal government covering 90% of the cost. But in many non-expansion states, most adults can't get full Medicaid coverage no matter how low their incomes are, unless they're pregnant, a parent, or have a disability. And coverage for parents is meager. In Alabama, for example, a single parent with two children can't even qualify for Medicaid if he or she makes more than $4,476 per year. 3 in 4 Americans say they have a favorable view of Medicaid, including a majority of Democrats, independents, and even Republicans, according to a poll early this year from Kaiser Family Foundation, a healthcare policy research organization. About 2/3 of people living in non-expansion states say they want their state to expand Medicaid. Seems if we had democracy, that would happen. In July, Georgia launched a partial Medicaid expansion program called Georgia Pathways to Coverage, and that state had to sue the federal government to enact. Georgia Pathways slightly relaxes the state's strict coverage rules so that adults with incomes up to 100% of the federal poverty level or who earn up to $14,600 a year are eligible for Medicaid. The plan makes Georgia the only state to currently require Medicaid recipients to work, a provision initially rejected by the Biden administration, though a few other states have tried work requirements in the past. Each month, Georgia recipients will have to complete 80 hours of work or job training to keep their coverage. But healthcare advocates have panned the program. Leah Chan, a health policy analyst at the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute, an Atlanta-based economic research and policy nonprofit, said that compared with full Medicaid expansion, Georgia Pathways will cost 5 times more per person while covering far fewer people. The state plans for about 100,000 people to gain coverage in the program's first year. If it reaches that number, coverage would cost the state about $2,500 per new enrollee, according to the Institute analysis. But full Medicaid expansion would make about 482,000 Georgians eligible for coverage and would cost less than $500 per enrollee. Since the Pathway program launched in July, a little more than 1,000 people have enrolled. And while it's too soon to say why enrollment has been so low, Chan said, the work requirement will likely have an impact on how many people are able to apply for and maintain their health insurance through the program. With this program, there's a lot of added layers of not just enrollment, but monthly reporting where you have to provide some verification of your 80 hours of employment, higher education, volunteering, etc. Even for people who are eligible, the act of doing that monthly reporting could keep them from being covered. Yeah, it's kind of like losing on all fronts. It costs more, it covers people less, and it's bureaucratically complicated. I don't know, maybe that's the Republican platform, particularly in Georgia. But expand Medicaid, people. My comment earlier on democracy was really an allusion to what I've talked to earlier, is that these 10 states are basically the only states that don't have state ballot proposal initiatives that are easy to put in place, making democracy possible. So even though 2/3 of people in these states support expanding Medicaid, there is not a democratic way to do that. So anti-democracy thrives, and our health suffers.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, I want to end my regular reporting for the show with a follow-up to a story that I've covered. This is about the European Union, which started out as a good story where they had some very robust plans to very much restrict toxic chemicals in consumer products. And then they were talking about scaling now. Now, basically, they're getting rid of it completely. This from The Guardian. EU abandons promise to ban toxic chemicals in consumer products. The EU has abandoned a promise to ban all but the most vital of toxic chemicals used in everyday consumer products, leaked documents show. Other legislation to be dropped includes a ban on the export of outlawed chemicals from Europe to the rest of the world, a ban on cage farming, and a sustainable food systems framework that the European Commission once described as, quote, a flagship of its farm-to-fork strategy. A wind power package will still be launched next year, as will a process to establish a 2040 climate target and a climate adaptation package, but there was no hiding the disappointment of environmentalists, and I would add public health advocates. Tatiana Santos, the head of chemicals policy at the European Environmental Bureau, a network of environmental citizens organizations, said that by shelving the promised review of the EU's REACH regulation that governs chemicals, the European Commission has betrayed European citizens, turning a blind eye to chemical pollution and a favored toxic industry short-term interests over those of its citizens. It is now clear that the profits of the chemical industry are more important to this commission than the health of Europeans. The European Green Deal will be remembered as the European Toxic Deal. Europe has almost 23% of the world's new cancer cases, despite making up only 6% of the world's population, in part because of chronic exposure to some pharmaceuticals, pollutants, and other occupational and environmental carcinogens, according to the European Environment Agency. So this is a disaster, although I would like to take a little bit of a teaching opportunity on that last paragraph. It was, you know, Europe has 23% of the world's new cancer cases and only 6% of the world's population. So that's almost a fourfold likelihood of having a new cancer case in Europe. And they're saying it's in part because of this chronic exposure to pharmaceuticals, pollutants, and other occupational environmental carcinogens. But I would note that this didn't really account for, like, for instance, age. Cancer is driven very much by age. European population is much older than the world's population. These are things that I look for, and if I were an editor of this article, I would have had them clarify and provide some context. But it basically, the point is still true that Europe is suffering from excess new cancer cases because of these toxic exposures, but we have to be as accurate as possible if we want to be good journalists and scientists. Thank you very much. Okay, well, that brings us to the last segment of the show, Bonus Articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all of the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. This week, we have 24 bonus articles, so let's get to it. Number one, study identifies the top 12 PFAS producers in the world and reveals shocking societal costs at 1,000 times the market price for PFAS chemicals. So this is a stunning example of how we are willing to externalize the cost of a consumer or industrial product for private profit, but we're basically causing costs for other people societally. And the fact that the PFAS chemicals produce 1,000 times more damage costs to society than what they, quote, cost in the marketplace is obscene and a very good example of why capitalism is killing us. Bonus article 2, FDA faces pressure to act nationwide on red dye in food. So this red dye is actually found in a lot of foods that are eaten more by kids. Now, these reds that they like in kid-type foods are actually, you know, red as a color that's not actually found in nature. And this red dye has been banned in cosmetics. You can't put it on your face or your body, but you can ingest it inside your body. That's a little crazy. Concentrations might be different, but the same principle applies. If they're dangerous to put on your skin, probably don't want to be eating them. And it's also just a sad commentary on the fact that we feel it necessary to teach our kids to eat things that are colors that don't resemble any food in nature. Just teaching kids to live in an artificial world. And on that note, bonus article 3. Once hailed as a drought fix, California moves to restrict synthetic turf over health concerns. So I reported on this before. One of the big studies that was done was about a baseball team that got an unholy amount of brain cancer for ball players that were, you know, practicing and playing on synthetic turf. In California, actually not too long ago, about a decade ago, actually was moving towards using synthetic turf. Basically, if you paint nature green, oh, we'll solve all our problems. But of course, it's a toxic nightmare. And now they're trying to get rid of it. That is good. Trying to fix one problem and cause another. We need to do it in a more natural, sustainable way. Bonus article 4. How gas utilities use tobacco industry tactics to avoid gas stove regulations. So this is one of the kind of public health issues that's joined the culture wars. You know, right-wingers saying that trying to regulate gas stoves is, you know, some deep state initiative or something. But if you want to talk about the real nefarious tactics used, look at the gas utilities basically using these tobacco industry tactics of disinformation in order to sell more of their products and make more money and diminish our health. Bonus article 5. Abortion coverage is limited or unavailable at a quarter of large workplaces. So these are large employers who have probably a little bit better health insurance than a lot of private employers, and a quarter of them have limited or unavailable abortion coverage. Basic health care for women is apparently not prioritized or considered important. Bonus article 6, information about abortion care largely omitted or buried on 80% of health systems' patient-facing websites. So if you go to a health system's website and try to learn about abortion care, it's either omitted or buried on 4 out of 5 of those health systems. Clearly, this politicization of health care is not serving women's or society's needs. Another women's issue, bonus article 7, more than a third of women under 50 are iron deficient. The condition can cause fatigue and other symptoms, but is rarely tested for. Again, not unusual that women's healthcare things are deprioritized. When they say women under 50, basically what they mean is women of childbearing age. That is women that are still menstruating, that are losing blood and iron. That drives a lot of the iron deficiency and why that's an at-risk group. Something to check out if you're a woman under 50 and have conditions like fatigue or are going to go to the doctor soon. May want to ask. Bonus article 8. Pregnant and addicted. Homeless women see hope in street medicine. So this is a follow-up of the one I did earlier in the show about allowing for Medicaid and Medicare to pay for street medicine, medicine that's delivered where homeless folks are at. And homeless women are at particular risk, and particularly women, homeless women that are addicted. You see a lot of pregnancies and a lot of need for reproductive care and substance abuse treatment, there's a lot of hope in street medicine if we can bolster that to help these homeless women and their children or their ability to do family planning. Bonus article 9. The mental health crisis among doctors is a problem for patients. So we may think of homeless folks as having mental health problems, but doctors do as well. And part of the problem is there is a stigma for doctors receiving help, and more than just a stigma, it may be a problem with licensing or employment if they reveal mental health issues. So getting help is difficult. And of course, having a mental health crisis among your doctor trickles down to patient care not being as good. Bonus article 10. Is there a nursing shortage in the United States? Depends on whom you ask. So the two sides of this is that hospitals, you know, which do not staff nursing to what they need to do, say that there's a nursing shortage. But of course, nurses say, well, you know, there's a million more registered nurses than there are slots for nurses in the country. So maybe it's just because nurses aren't willing to work on the horrific conditions that nurses, because there's a shortage of staff, do not have good conditions, subject themselves to moral injury, having to do things that they know are not good for the patient, but they don't have any other choice because they're understaffed and not supported. So if we treat nurses well, they will be there to treat us well. Bonus article 11. Studies highlight risks of excluding people with obesity from drug trials. So this gets at a couple things. First, that in doing drug trials, companies are trying to find drugs that work, that are both considered safe and effective, don't have a lot of side effects, particularly dangerous ones. And that when you they usually have a lot of exclusions that tends to bias the drug trials towards much healthier people and not actually a representative sample of people who ultimately may be taking the drug in the open market. And of course, people with obesity metabolize drugs slightly different than people who aren't obese, so it could affect dosing as well as underestimating the amount, the type, and the severity of side effects that may happen. We need to do representative samples, not just meet the needs for pharmaceutical profiteers trying to squeak by in their drug trials. Bonus article 12. As the number of vaccines for pregnant women rises, so does vaccine hesitancy. So there's been a couple new added vaccines for pregnant women. COVID, of course, since the COVID pandemic. And RSV is a brand new one that can help pregnant women and their newborn babies. It transfers immunity early in life when the kids are most vulnerable, and that's when RSV is most dangerous for those kids in those early months. But as we've seen, that vaccine hesitancy has risen in recent years. This is also affecting pregnant women, some who have one of the best opportunities to benefit from vaccines. Bonus article 13. Teeny rural hospitals feel the pinch as Medicare Advantage plans grow. So Medicare Advantage plans overall are now is over half of the people that are on Medicare. The remaining ones are on traditional Medicare. And traditional Medicare, you're required to be accepted by any Medicare provider. Medicare Advantage has its own limited networks of providers. So this is a problem for people everywhere. There's slightly less Medicare Advantage in rural areas, but that's growing and it will catch up in the next 2 or 3 years. But the problem is these small hospitals have to accept, if they want to be providers for Medicare Advantage plans, have to accept lower rates than traditional Medicare Advantage, and many rural hospitals are already financially on the edge. So as the privatization of Medicare through Medicare Advantage grows, it's putting a pinch on rural hospitals, all hospitals actually, doesn't overall provide better care, and is just a cancerous growth of profiteering in healthcare, which is American healthcare, unfortunately. Bonus article 14, using opioid settlement cash for police gear like squad cars and scanners sparks debate. So we've gone through different rounds of this. I've spoken before about how a lot of the tobacco settlement for billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars was basically used to supplant, you know, state budgets and that type of thing. But this one's even a little more ironic in the sense that the opioid crisis is not dealt with very well from a law enforcement perspective. And some states and localities are actually prioritizing law enforcement for getting this opiate settlement money on the false assumption that increased law enforcement will somehow benefit the opioid crisis. In fact, I've reported before that sometimes the kind of drug prosecution, indictment, and criminalization of opioid users, substance users, has actually increased opioid deaths. Bonus Article 15. Why failed psychiatry lives on: its industrial complex, politics, and technology worship. So this is another great one from one of my favorite mental health websites, Mad in America. And it's a long tome, good long read if you want to understand how poorly psychiatry has performed and the industry behind it and some cultural issues, the politics and technology worship particularly. Bonus Article 16 is a very interesting story for a lot of reasons. Ketamine's effect on depression may hinge on hope. So if you want to call it an individual or a societal determinant, hope. This was an interesting study because ketamine and its effect on depression is very hard to measure because it's hard to do a blinded study because ketamine has such funky effects on you. People generally know when they get the drug. But what they did is they took people that had a depression diagnosis and were going to undergo surgery, and ketamine, its only approved use, is actually as a sedative. And it turned out that there was no difference from the placebo or from the treatment with ketamine. But the interesting thing is the placebo effect or the expectancy effect, whatever you want to call it, as from the title of this article, you may want to even call it hope, is that people that thought that they got the ketamine or saw that there was some change attributed to ketamine, even if they didn't get the ketamine, it was more related to their expectancy, that effect, rather than the actual chemical effects of the drug. Very interesting study. Bonus Article 17. I'm a neurosurgeon. Social media may change your kid's brain. So this is another one in our changing world. And kids, particularly who have developing brains, are subject to a lot of social media and changes. So if you want to get a rundown of what some of those things may be, a little wonky from a neurologist point of view, Bonus Article 17 is for you. Bonus Article 18, fatty liver disease rising in kids as ultra-processed diets surge. So this is one of those things where fatty liver disease was something that was seen in adults, and it's been growing progressively earlier and earlier. And one of the key drivers is putting kids on ultra-processed diets, which the U.S. is the worst, and it's driving this fatty liver disease. Another example of living in an unnatural world. We need to fix our food system to improve our diet and our health. Bonus Article 19. Dementia's staggering financial costs revealed in new report. It's bankrupting families. So dementia is something that, like a lot of healthcare, can be very expensive. But dementia specifically brings a lot of costs to households that aren't covered by insurance. And the kind of care and healthcare that's required is impoverishing families and even bankrupting families. Okay, well, if that doesn't make you lose some sleep, you can look at Bonus Article 20. Sleep problems can increase as you age. These tips can help. So this is a good overview of some of the changes that happen as we age regarding sleep, and a good overview of things you can do to help mitigate those changes and protect your health. Bonus Article 21. U.S. income inequality grew through pandemic years despite massive income support. So this is just another case of the rich going richer and the poor growing poorer. So it was an interesting social experiment to do massive income support during the pandemic. But even as much as that might have been to be targeted, the benefits benefited the higher income folks more than lower income folks. And in fact, income inequality grew. Bonus Article 22. Tobacco purchases rise following restrictions on e-cigarette sales. This is a testament to the powerful addictive nature of nicotine. If you do not heavily regulate nicotine, whether it's from tobacco or e-cigarettes, what you'll find is that the nicotine purveyors will get you hooked, particularly when you're young. And then if you restrict e-cigarette sales, they'll find another outlet, which would be tobacco, which of course for minors is still legal in most places, but that kind of addiction drives the use of these products. Bonus article 23, a local story, a regional story. Lake Erie is full of algae again. Southwestern Ontario's exploding greenhouse sector won't help. So our neighbor to the north in Canada has a lot of greenhouses on the waterfront there growing vegetables and cannabis. If you differentiate this too, some would consider cannabis a vegetable. But it's dumping a lot of waste into Lake Erie and causing driving algae blooms. Lastly but not least, bonus article 24, the key to stopping tooth decay is limiting refined sugars. So I used to think about, you know, the way that dental health was a lot about, you know, Florida, of course, is good. And, you know, brushing your teeth and other mechanical things like flossing. But that all depends. Those things can work. But it all depends on the fact that you're trying to mitigate the effects of refined sugar in your diet. If you bring refined sugars down to 2 or 3% of the calories of your diet, tooth decay actually stops. And you don't even actually need those other things, although you might want to do it just for basic hygiene. Don't want to have bad breath, folks. But that's different than the public health problem that is tooth decay and such, periodontal disease. Okay, you can listen and read these and all other stories by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-